which is, oh dear, 093621 USA versus Lewis Hopkins. Argument has been waived, and we're going to take a 5-minute break. But we promise we're coming back. Okay. All right. Appeal 092700, United States versus Charles Suggs. And it's Mr. Daisy. Good morning. Good
morning, Your Honor.
Yes, good morning.
Please, the court, counsel, Bill Daisy for Indiana Federal Community Defenders. Mr. Suggs' case is on direct appeal. He raises only a sentencing issue. He pled guilty to a 922G charge of possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. The argument made at his sentencing and on appeal is that although he possessed a firearm while he resisted law enforcement at the time of his arrest, he did not commit the Indiana felony offense of resisting law enforcement while armed. The argument that I would call creative was that the Indiana statute would provide that resisting law enforcement becomes a felony if a defendant drew or used the weapon at the time of the arrest. The court may recall that Mr. Suggs had driven erratically, chose the parking lot of the jail as a place to pull into when the police were following him for reasons.
Not a wise decision. I don't think he made a lot of wise decisions.
We've never figured that one out. No, the police told him not to be digging around in his truck. He did anyway and picked up a weapon either from under the front seat of the truck or the floorboard and wasn't given a chance to use it because of quick action by law enforcement. Use in the sense that the weapon wasn't employed actively to resist law enforcement. And the argument being that he didn't draw the weapon. The argument rests on a 1961 Indiana Supreme Court decision that on its face seems kind of trivial, but I would argue that the Indiana Supreme Court was sort of trying to make sense out of the hand that the legislature dealt it, which is the legislature had created separate offenses for drawing a weapon, aiming a weapon, pointing a weapon, and having drawn the weapon, threatening someone. And so looking at the kinds of objects that the statute prohibited drawing, which included a dirk, a pistol, swung shot, the court concluded that what the legislature had in mind was the Old West version of drawing a weapon, pulling it out of a sheath or some enclosure. So the argument to the district judge at sentencing was that picking the gun up from the floorboard of the car was not drawing a weapon.
But in terms of the seriousness of the offense, the danger presented by the act of resisting the officers, why would it matter where he pulled the gun from? Possessing the weapon under the seat, you know, that posed one kind of risk to the officers. But pulling it out and holding it presented a much more dire risk, no matter where, you know, if he pulls it from the air, if he pulls it from his hair, if he pulls it from under the seat.
That's exactly, of course, the view Judge Hamilton took, which was it really didn't much matter to the district court whether he technically violated the Indiana statute or not. The court focused in its findings on the fact that that's really a bad thing. We shouldn't have people pulling out loaded weapons while policemen are telling them not to. So, which leads to the point, I could be right about the guideline adjustment and lose the case, of course. The court has hit exactly on how how Judge Hamilton dealt in his findings with the offense conduct and the history and characteristics of the defendant. So our argument is that the Indiana statute is narrow, that it's limited by its terms, that he didn't violate that statute, that he possessed his weapon in connection with a misdemeanor offense of resisting law enforcement. That is, although he possessed the gun while resisting law enforcement, he didn't commit that felony offense. And that the court, having considered an erroneous guideline, the case should be remanded for further consideration.
Of course, the judge, Judge Hamilton, said that really regardless of whether or not he was right under the guidelines, he would have sentenced him the same anyway because of his long criminal record.
That's precisely what the court held. So the situation would be, if the court thinks finds that this is a good argument, that the guidelines were miscalculated, but that the court is certain. I mean, looking at the language of Zahirsky, I think the court is certain that the court would reach no different result on remand, and that given the correct guideline, if the court finds that the correct guideline would have been computed without this four-point adjustment for possession of the weapon in connection with another felony offense, if the court finds that sentence was reasonable, adequately explained by the court, then I'll lose this appeal. So we argued that the court incorrectly calculated the guideline. The correct guideline would have started about 47 months. Mr. Suggs was awarded 108 months, significantly higher than the guideline that the court found did apply to this case. And I think the best I can do on that argument would be that vast difference between what we would argue to be the correct guideline and the sentence imposed, under those circumstances, the court should be invited to reconsider his sentence.
Let me ask a legal question.
Yes.
When the felony version of the resisting offense under Indiana law is submitted to a jury, how is that jury instructed?
I've never tried one.
Well,
I don't know.
Presumably you don't have to try one to find out because
yes.
There's jury instructions somewhere in the library, right?
Probably so. I would think it would track the statute, and I would think the jury would be instructed that if you find the defendant drew or used the weapon in connection at the time of the offense.
Are they going to be given an instruction that conforms to this Dunkel case and this 1961 case that you referenced and narrows the scope of drew a weapon distinction that gets the offense into the felony category? Probably not.
It seems to me that if the facts presented that issue, the defense counsel ought to tender that instruction and that it ought to be given. This Allen case that dealt with the fellow that picked the steak knife up out of the sink and went chasing the victim around the apartment with it. I mean, in that which the government cites, Allen, I believe is the name of the case. That case, the defendant actually was using the weapon. He was trying to stab the lady, trying to stab around somebody. But
you don't have a question.
In that case,
whether
it wouldn't matter. What would it matter if the jury was given that instruction or not? If this case were tried to a jury, and I would think I would tender that instruction and ask the judge to give it anyway, that this weapon wasn't drawn under the facts and circumstances.
The import of my question is that I'm trying to get at how the Indiana courts read this Dunkel case as some sort of a limiting principle on the act of drawing a weapon for purposes of the felony resisting offense, and I would doubt that that's how that case is being read. It just doesn't make sense to me. That was the fact pattern in Dunkel, apparently, but and that case was trying to draw a distinction between several different statutory subsections, a distinction between drawing and pointing and aiming, et cetera. So there was a reason to make that distinction, but that reason doesn't exist in the ordinary case where a lot of different acts can constitute a drawing of a weapon.
I think it's a fair statement.
And so you let the jury decide rather than putting a legal limitation on it?
Ultimately, there is that legal limitation. The Wise case, when the district court judge took a time out and read Dunkel and came back and said, I read this Wise case also, which the government cites, It was a case where the defendant wrestled the weapon away from a police officer he was fighting with, and was one of the counts of his conviction involved drawing the weapon. And the Court of Appeals in that case said, no, I didn't draw the weapon. That particular count was reversed. So it matters. It can matter under a variety of circumstances. And I think it's, in the context of this case, purely from the standpoint of the sentencing guidelines, I would argue that it does matter. And I thank the Court for its indulgence.
Mr. Rinka.
May it please the Court, Mr. Daisy.
Do you know what the Indiana jury instructions say on this offense?
Judge, I haven't seen jury instructions for this particular offense. It was interesting to the government in looking through these that, one, that the statute didn't define it itself, and two, that when they were looking to define it, both in Dunkel and in the Hall case that we cited later on, which is much more recent, we find the Indiana Supreme Court going to the dictionary and getting an ordinary common sense meaning for to draw. And in those cases, Judge, it's interesting to the government that both courts in Dunkel and in Hall focus on the act of drawing. It's the taking out. It's the displaying. As opposed to,
if the gun had been in a holster under the seat and he pulls out the holster with the gun still inside it, would he have been drawing the gun?
That's a very good point, Judge. I think probably, I apologize. The answer to your question, I believe, is yes. If Mr. Suggs had reached under that seat and pulled out a handgun that was in a holster and displayed both, I think the argument could certainly be made that he was drawing that weapon, because in some holsters you can actually pull a trigger and fire through the holster. You don't have to pull the gun out of the holster in order to use it.
What if it wasn't that kind of holster?
I'm sorry, Judge.
What if it wasn't that kind of holster?
Skippery.
Again, I think the answer again is yes. However, the government moves back to the position that we're really talking about the act of pulling out that weapon to display it. That is the key issue. It is not the container that it was in. It was not the size, the shape, the purpose. If he pulled a gun wrapped in a bandana out from underneath the seat, drawing it. In the government's view, it's that act of pulling that gun out, which, as I think Judge Hamilton very clearly pointed out in his decision at the sentencing hearing, the concern for him was that split-second timing, the difference between drawing it out and actually pointing it and using it, a fully loaded firearm such as this, with the kind of ammunition this gun was loaded with, was something to him that he felt was perhaps putting a little bit too much weight on this very hyper-technical determination of whether or not this gun was drawn.
What if Mr. Suggs had said, wait, I have a gun here. I want to give it to you.
Well, certainly, Judge, I think that probably would have been the better practice for Mr. Suggs if he had just followed the officer's command, stepped to the back of the truck, and said, look, I do have a firearm under the seat. You go get it. He's not employing it. He's not touching it. He's alerting the officer to it. I don't think we'd be here today. We may have charged him with felon in possession of a firearm, but I don't think we'd be arguing over this 4 points. The government's position at sentencing, as it remains today, is that Mr. Suggs' intention was not, though, to turn that over to law enforcement. And the government envisions a very scary scenario, which if Mr. Suggs had actually been able to retrieve that firearm, Officer Settlemore and his partner would have faced a much different situation than that.
There's no question that this is a far more serious case because of the manner in which the defendant dealt with the weapon that was in the car, and that it's qualitatively a grounds for a longer sentence and to view the crime in a more serious way. The question, though, is the application of this enhancement that requires possession of the firearm and commission of another felony. So we really need to focus on the elements of the Indiana felony to determine whether they're satisfied here. That's the issue, not whether you know, a longer sentence is justified because it certainly is based on what went down here. But the question is, does this qualify as that felony resisting under Indiana law? And that's why I asked about the jury instructions. It seems to me that unless Indiana juries are instructed on a very narrow definition of drawing, a reasonable jury is going to convict this defendant of felony resisting if he were charged with that in an Indiana court.
Sorry.
But that, I don't know how juries are instructed on this offense.
And nor do I, and I apologize, I can't directly address the jury instruction situation, but the issue with respect to, like as I indicated earlier, both the Indiana Supreme Court case of Dunkel and Hall referring to the dictionary, and I know from our own instructions here in the Seventh Circuit, there are some very, I don't want to call them common sense terms, but some very everyday, ordinary terms that we have in our own parlance that we don't specifically define for a jury because they are that very common. I mean, reasonable doubt is one of them. We don't ever kind of wade into that. What is reasonable doubt?
Well, we do in Wisconsin. But you wouldn't be expected to know that.
So, again, I think that perhaps what the Supreme Court is telling us in these cases, the Supreme Court of Indiana is telling us in these cases, is that draw is just a very ordinary term. It's not necessarily helpful for us here today as we discuss whether or not his activity is, constitutes drawing. But I think that they send a very strong signal in those two cases when they say, let's look at the common dictionary version definition of draw. And it is that act that they focus on, not the container that it was in, but the act of pulling it out. And, of course, all of that being said, the second very compelling reason why the district judge's decision at sentencing should be upheld is that, in the government's view, this was a harmless error, if it was error at all, specifically with respect to the fact that, for reasons very clearly articulated by the district court at the sentencing hearing, the district court felt that, in this particular case, it would have chosen the same exact sentence regardless of whether or not this four-point enhancement was added to Mr. Suggs' base offense level. And in support of that, actually, the district court judge departed upwards from the calculated guideline sentence by a significant amount. I think the range was, as calculated, 70 to 87 months, and the district judge imposed a 108-month sentence, indicating that he felt it was somewhat of a silly rule that the guidelines did not take into effect that 1978 robbery conviction when, very quickly thereafter, Mr. Suggs was arrested and convicted of murder and then spent the ensuing 20 years in prison. The district court felt that, to some extent, his criminal history with respect to that additional bump that he would receive for counting that robbery conviction was underrepresented.
The gun was stolen.
I'm sorry, Judge.
The gun was stolen.
The gun was stolen. He had a stolen credit card on his person, all of which the gun was stolen on the 7th of April, I believe, the credit card on the 27th of April, and Mr. Suggs was arrested on the 29th. So.
And it's loaded with hollow point bullets.
So we have a significant amount of criminal activity in a very short period of time immediately after he gets out of prison.
Yeah.
So in any event, the government's position remains that, one, the application was not error, and two, that even if it was error, the error would have been harmless because the district court would have imposed the exact same sentence regardless of the application of that guideline provision.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. You have time for rebuttal. Do you want it?
I'll be quiet in the invitation.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Well, thanks to both of you. Have good trips back. And the case will be taken under advisement.